Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. It is my great pleasure to be in the company of Bill Russell, as usual, and Billy Collins, as quite unusual. I think that we led you to a place where you'd like to read us a poem.
I'd like to read this poem about not having anything to write on. It's always good advice, you know, to young poets to carry a journal with you and a pen, so that because poetry might strike you at any second. And this is about being caught out without the equipment. It's called Lines Lost Among Trees. And I'll just mention there is a word toward the end, the word envoy, and it's a literary term which means an author's farewell to his book. At the end of a book, it was a convention in some medieval poems for the author to bid his work goodbye. Lines Lost Among Trees. These are not the lines that came to me while walking in the woods with no pen and nothing to write on anyway. They are gone forever, a handful of coins dropped through the grate of memory, along with the ingenious mnemonic I devised to hold them in place, all gone and forgotten before I had returned to the clearing of lawn in back of our quiet house, with its jars jammed with pens, its notebooks and reams of blank paper, its desk and soft lamp, its table and the light from its windows. So this is my elegy for them, those six or eight exhalations, the braided rope of the syntax, the jazz of the timing, and the little insight at the end, wagging like the short tail of a perfectly obedient spaniel sitting by the door. This is my envoy to nothing, where I say, go, little poem, not out into the world of strangers' eyes, but off to some airy limbo, home to lost epics, unremembered names, and fugitive dreams, such as the one I had last night, which, like a fantastic city in pencil, erased itself in the bright morning air just as I was waking up. So it's also about how it really turns out to be about something else, which is how dreams evaporate as you're about to remember them. And I think that was a good. I think I like that image of a city drawn in pencil that somehow erases itself like an etch-a-sketch.
It was very tempting to mark up the poetry book.
You go ahead.
Well,
Nabokov says a good reader reads with a dictionary and a pencil.
That image of the pencil being able to erase the city was just so strong that I had to write in my book on that one.
Good.
As I read these poems, I tried to imagine your voice.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a real blessing to hear your voice in reality. And then I began to wonder, does he imagine my voice or my ear?
Uh-huh. Thomas Lux has a very good poem about the fact that when we read in silence, that we're really not reading in silence. We're hearing a voice in the auditorium of the mind. And we hear our voice, or some voice. So, well, I'm always imagining a reader. Yeah, I'm always, these poems are meant to be fairly intimate communications between me and one other person.
So we're in this together.
Yeah. I perform half of the exchange, and when the reader arrives, the exchange is completed. So I do give a lot of public readings and interviews and things of that nature, but I'm not writing for the podium or for the microphone. I'm writing for a single person sitting in a room alone reading in silence.
Do you have a picture of that person?
No.
Not needed, huh?
No, just a sense of being accompanied. That person is probably close to the imaginary friend I used to have as a child who has now grown up and taken an interest in poetry.
That secretive little boy.
Yeah, that little invisible elfish companion that most boys have.
Did you, in fact, lose that when you turned 10? You have a wonderful poem about turning 10 and being quite bereft.
Yeah, well, part of growing up is you have to kick out your imaginary friends.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I guess we start looking for other kinds of, companionship that can give us a little more feedback.
Oh, I don't know. My imaginary friends are quite...
they talk to you, yeah.
You talk about Dick and Jane. You write a poem about Dick and Jane and how that learning to read can be a very constraining. On the one hand,
those of you who did not grow up with Dick and Jane, there are three people in this room who did grow up and who learned to read with Dick and Jane.
Yeah.
which is full of very simple words and very, very simple phrases and a very...
very simple life.
A very stunningly white American middle class desiccated environment.
In the 50s.
But, you know, it opens up worlds that you point to, but it also constrains worlds. And it seems that that's some of the same challenge.
You know, an interesting... Well, a footnote to that is that I actually did not have... I had the same, these little primers, these books, but I went to Catholic school, and in Catholic schools, we didn't have Dick and Jane. I didn't know why this was the case. We had David and Anne. It was the same stuff. Look, David, look. See, David. See, Anne. Exact same, you know, kind of mindless copy or a text. And I realized at some point that as Catholics, we were always encouraged, this is in the 50s, to be named after saints. And there's no...
no St. Richard and no St. Jane.
There's no St. Dick, and there's no St. Jane.
Yeah.
And there's a St. David and a St. Anne.
So was it really the same illustrations every day?
Yeah, same. I think, I don't know if it's the same company, but it looked exactly the same. It had the same sky, and Mom had the apron on, and there was a dog with a doghouse, but they just happened to be David and Anne.
Does it matter?
Well, to some Catholic educators, it seemed to matter a lot. We're not going to have any Dick or Jane running or corrupting our children. You know?
Catholic exceptionalism.
Right.
I've come to think of the written language and the spoken language, even in the same language, English as an example, as really different languages. And it seems that part of the challenge of writing poetry or anything that's going to be presented aloud as well as read silently, unless, of course, you move your lips as you read. Does that enter into because
the two
you,
kinds
you,
of
you
language
do,
embedded
you do
in
both
one?
Very much.
Well, I think poetry has a is meant to be vocalized in the way that prose isn't. Most of the devices that are used in poetry, like meter and rhyme and assonance and other kinds of tropes or effects, are really meant to give the ear pleasure in a way that prose does not. And poetry, I think, also appeals to the ear because poetry is, I think, an interruption of silence, whereas prose, you're talking about reading books about economics and geopolitics. And prose, especially of that kind, for me, is basically a continuation of noise.
I sometimes share that feeling. Loud noise.
But I think a poem should be preceded by silence and followed by silence. And poetry, a poem for me, displaces silence the way your body displaces water. So I think poetry has a strongly vocal appeal.
As one is writing one's own poem, I must say I was really drawn as I read through the poetry book that there were four or five pages at the end that were blank. And I thought, okay, this is has to do, my first thought was, this is because that's a folio and that's how many pages there are, and so that's what they did when they bound the book. And then I thought, no, let's go a little farther. This is either an invitation for me to start writing poems at the end, or perhaps it is a promise from Billy Collins, that there will be more. So this sense of the participation in the event and that there are white pages at the end, you are also inviting me not only to think about your experience, but also to do some of that work myself, aren't you?
Well, that is just that's just the publisher, I guess. But I'm always glad to find blank pages at the end of a book
because you
can, if you forgot your paper, you can write there.
You do invite us to do our own poetic work, don't you?
Well, I invite you to listen. I mean, I'm not trying to encourage people to write poetry. I'm trying to encourage them to listen to my poetry. But I don't know.
Where does craft come into this? Because it seems to me that one of the reasons that I don't write poetry is because there is craft that's standing between me and doing it, and it takes a lot of work.
Well, craft is something I think you learn very slowly, and that you get to a point where you internalize it finally, and you learn it by reading others. You can't over emphasize the importance of reading other poetry in order to write poetry. And at some point, the rhythms of the poem and the sense of what a stanza is and what constitutes a line will become internalized, and you'll be able to do it without thinking about, I'm being a craftsman here. It's more, it becomes more attached to your breathing and your ear. Those faculties allow you to sense the way the poem is going.
Does the poem have its own life that you get to express?
Well, I think when I'm finished with a poem, I'm done with it. I mean, I'm not interested in any of the poems I've written, except maybe the last one and the next one. But if you see me reading my own poems, just hit me on the head with a frying pan or something. Once they're
done.
You mean
done, if you're not in public reading them.
Yeah, that's right. If you catch me at home in an easy chair going through my poems and humming and appreciation.
But, cheering, yeah. Applauding.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
That will be a no.
Into the mirror.
This is Billy Collins, yeah. And Bill Russell will have a chance to continue that thought in just a moment when we return. Please be with us when that happens.